Good morning. Well, so far we've opened up the question of inspiration, and we looked at the prophets and tried to see what inspiration might mean in regard to them. Neither of those topics is completed. I've just opened them up for you, and I presume you'll keep pondering them till the end of our 17th presentation, because they keep opening up. I basically indicated yesterday, I think it's true, that the prophets basically did not foretell the future. And they didn't foretell Jesus. He would have come as a complete surprise to all of them. But they were speaking the truth as best they could in love to their contemporaries, and inspired to do so. I want to shift now to another series of writings in the Bible, the books of wisdom. There are a number of writings in the Hebrew Bible that are concerned with wisdom. A few of the Psalms. In the 5th century BC, we have the Song of Songs, the Book of Job. We'll say something about each of these in turn, but briefly later. And in the 4th century, the Book of Proverbs, though some of the Proverbs go way back. It's one of those things that just keeps growing. But the final edition we've got seems to have come from the 4th century, and the Book of Ecclesiastes. These are all found in the Hebrew Bible. From the Greek, Jewish, Greek Septuagint, there are a number of other works that are considered in this list of books of wisdom. One is the book of Ben Sira, or the book of Sirach, or Ecclesiasticus sometimes called. There's the book of Baruch, the secretary for Jeremiah, but the book's not written by him, it's written later on. And then a totally marvellous book called the Book of Wisdom, or the Wisdom of Solomon, which is, as I might have mentioned yesterday, it's the only really Greek book in the Bible, in the Old Testament scriptures, written in Greek and written in a Greek world and written from a whole Greek perspective. The other books, Sirach, Baruch, etc. and the rest, yes, we've got the Greek version of them, but they're translated from an original Hebrew, or Semitic, it might be Aramaic in some cases, which has been lost sometimes, because since it wasn't part of the Jewish canon, there was no good reason for keeping it and translating it and copying it. So the Greek is the one that survived. All right. The people of ancient Israel, like the people everywhere in the surrounding countries, they looked up to men and women who were perceived as being wise, don't we? We all want to get on in the world, but we have to learn how best to respond to the situations in which we find ourselves. Life is complex. And we know from experience that some decisions we make lead to outcomes that work for us and for our neighbour. Other decisions lead to consequences that are unpleasant or worse. So we're always trying to be wise in the decisions we make and the directions we take. A farmer, simple examples if I may, but this is basic to the wisdom literature of the Bible. A farmer needs to be able to read the seasons and manage unseasonable weather. Drought, grasshopper plague, and much besides. Some things are completely beyond our control, and we just have to accept and make the best of misfortune, now as then. But in ordinary circumstances, managing a farm has to be learned. So we seek the advice of an experienced and wise farmer. It's the same for raising a family, managing a home. Husbands and wives seek advice. then as now. And they seek out a wise person to direct them along a path that works. Parenting too is a skill that can be learned. And this is modern, it's ancient. And the books of wisdom are full of practical things concerning such matters. Similarly with getting on with our neighbours and contributing to the community or the village, rather than being a neutral or destructive presence. That can be learned. And there are wise people around we can learn from. So it's here that we should look for the origin of many of the wise sayings found in the older Testament. These sayings are, for the most part, the fruit of experience. They become part of the oral tradition, handed on from mother to daughter, father to son. They had a lesson for everyone, but were used especially to prepare the young to help them avoid falling into the many pitfalls that life presents, by instructing them how to live in such a way as to find personal fulfillment, as well as to contribute to the welfare of the community. I think all that's totally obvious to you, I'm sure, but it is central to approach the books of wisdom from this angle. There are hundreds of memorable one-liners in the oldest sections of one of the oldest books of the Israel wisdom, namely the Book of Proverbs. One-liners, I'll give you an English example, it's not in the Book of Proverbs. A stitch in time saves nine. Well, we all heard that as kids, and I've never stitched anything. But the lesson in it is there to somehow teach us something. And they were full of these one-liners too. Of course, the wisdom books as we have them are the product of literary activity. So it's not just oral wisdom handed on through the tradition, though that's the basis of it. Now we're dealing with literature, so that brings another element in. We shouldn't be surprised to find that brief and memorable one-liners from the oral tradition are sometimes expanded by the scribes, eager to direct the students' attention to consider a specific application of the wisdom contained in the saying or the proverb. They did this by adding one or two sentences to motivate learning and to draw out consequences of heeding or disregarding the lesson. So if, and we'll do a little bit of it later, if you opened up the Book of Proverbs, you get little one-liners, one verse, one line, and in other cases you'll get little paragraphs on an issue, spelt out, drawn out, as a teacher would, to make apply the meaning of that little thing to daily life. As the tribes of Israel moved beyond subsistence farming and they formed a state and they built up complex systems needed to manage a state and to relate to surrounding states like Egypt or Moab or Edom in a way that worked to their own advantage, many skills had to be acquired that don't belong to the household or the farm. Statesmen, military commanders, public servants can make foolish decisions. They can make wise decisions. Israel needed people who'd successfully applied their intelligence to learn from their experience how best to make those decisions that would benefit Israel or benefit Judah. So we're going to find a fair bit of that too in the wisdom literature. So many of the wise sayings and the various books of Israelite wisdom focus on teaching keen young men, and I mean men because the men went to school and the women didn't. They were at home, kind of invisible really, in the public arena. So it was young men, hence when you read some of the wisdom sayings, they're very male-centred, And they're also not always respectful of the female because their culture wasn't. Many of the wise sayings were in the various books focus on teaching keen young men who were aspiring to a career in government or administration. And many of these sayings were influenced by the experience of cultures that were much older than Israel. Cultures such as Assyria, they learnt from them. When they became a state, Assyria was a much older state. They learnt from them. Babylon, but particularly Egypt. And there are actually whole sections of the wisdom literature that are actually borrowed from Egyptian wisdom. We've got the originals and then we see the Hebrew version copied from it. So far, we've been focusing here on sayings and instructions that are based on experience, whether it be the ancient experience of everyday life, the origins of which are lost in the mists of time, or more recent experience that comes from the development of the city-state and interaction with foreign nations. So much of the material found in the books of Israelite wisdom has its basis in these experiences. Much of it, however, now we're shifting, is based on faith in God. This is something that gives a new light to some of the things that you'll find. It's based on faith in God and on the religious traditions of Israel. Not learnt from experience, but learnt from the Torah, learnt from cultic practice, learnt from the religious environment in which they lived and the God in whom they believed. The wisdom teachers of Israel are integrating wisdom with religious commitment. In Egyptian wisdom literature, the stability and continuity of the state relies on respect for divinely established order. So you find, if you were to read the Mesopotamian wisdom or the Assyrian wisdom or the Egyptian wisdom, it's all about keeping order with the ruler on top. So it's maintaining the status quo very much. Israel, it's going to be different. Wisdom is seen as a gift of Yahweh, and it can be quite critical of the established order, rightly so. So there's a new perspective here that you don't find in the surrounding countries. So the aim of wisdom is to live a good, productive life. People of ancient Israel knew that such a life had its source in God, the Creator, and has as its goal a life of communion with God, not just good relations with neighbour, but communion with God. A communion experienced in nature, in communal living, whether in the country or the city, and in the events of daily life. What sets the teachers of wisdom apart from the priests and prophets, priests responsible for the cult, prophets we've already talked a little bit about, is that the primary focus of the teachers of wisdom is not the Torah. That's not its primary focus. And it's not obedience to divine inspiration. It's shrewd observance of life experience, including religious experience. But that's what its focus is. Day-to-day running of a farm or managing a family can't wait for prophetic revelation or priestly instruction. People need to apply their mind honestly to what's happening in their lives and behave as mindfully as they can. Learning from the wise. They're not going to check with the priest and they're not going to wait for a prophet to rise to tell them what to do. They've got to get on with their farm or their family life or their business or whatever. God has given us intelligence so that we'll think things through. Decisions should use a modern term, should be evidence-based. not faith-based, but evidence-based. So the teachers of wisdom respected the Torah, and at times relied on it, but this respect couldn't substitute for mindful living. A person who's faithful to the Torah, but who stumbles from one foolish decision to another, is a prisoner of circumstance, an unwise person. Wisdom liberates. It opens a person up to possibilities of living well. A wise king, a wise statesman, a wise administrator of justice, a wise public servant, a wise farmer, a wise artisan, a wise trader, a wise grandmother, a wise teacher. These are all blessings from God, and of course, basic to human living. But wisdom, as you know, doesn't come automatically or cheaply. It's the fruit of living a thoughtful, intelligent life in the real world. The aim of the books of Israelite wisdom is to help educate people in how to do this by sharing traditional and current wisdom. The instructions and most of the wise sayings state how a person is to behave in his personal life or public career. They aim to teach, but more importantly, to get people to think about their lives. If perchance you're going to look through the book of Proverbs, you'll find, and often enough, one proverb will say something, and the very next proverb would appear to be contradicting it. And that's very good, because none of them contain the full wisdom, so the author, the people who jumbled them that way, is saying, oh yeah, that's what a good idea that is. And the next thing, that seems to be a good idea too. So you've got to start thinking, which one applies to me? How do I handle all this? What one is really wise in this circumstance? It's meant to get the students, the people, thinking mindfully. Traditions, however wise, cannot be inflexible. New situations require new thinking and new decisions. And you'll find plenty of that in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. Particularly, I won't go into this now, the book of Job and the book of Ecclesiastes are absolutely questioning the traditional wisdom that's been handed down. They're saying, no, it doesn't work. And Ecclesiastes is a brilliant piece of work, absolutely brilliant, and very, very critical of what was being handed down as wise, which may have worked back then, maybe, but it's not working in the real world of the post-exilic Judah. So the Bible itself is questioning the Bible. Older wisdom has been questioned by newer wisdom, as it should be. But that too has implications when you think of, what do you mean by inspiration? Why would you call that earlier one inspired? We've just got to move with this and struggle with the issues. Now, the introduction to the book of Proverbs opens with the words, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. In the book of Kings, written by the Deuteronomists, whom I'll talk about later, we read this. Book of Kings, 1 Kings, chapter 4. Solomon composed 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. Don't ask me where they got that from, but there they are, that's what they said. If you know a little bit about Solomon's life, you wonder how he got time to write all this, but anyhow, there it is. Here's a bit later in the book of Kings, or actually fraction earlier. God gave Solomon very great wisdom, discernment, and breadth of understanding as vast as the sand on the seashore. And also in the book of Kings, King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. So he's the symbol, the icon of what it is to be wise. We find this tradition continued in the New Testament. On the lips of Jesus, we hear said, Matthew chapter 12, the Queen of the South, Queen of Sheba, will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. Because she came, says Jesus, from the ends of the earth to listen to the wisdom of Solomon and see there's something greater than Solomon here. Brackets, and you're not listening. He's come to you and you're dismissing what he's saying. So in the Hebrew Bible, the Song of Songs and Ecclesiastes are also attributed to Solomon. Of course, he didn't write either of them. He couldn't have. It was way before writing there even existed in this part of the world. So, but he's the one they attributed to. As is the wisdom of Solomon in the Septuagint, the last book of the Bible. In each case, the material is linked to the man whom tradition saw as the wisest of men. The editors are claiming, by doing that, that these books can offer authoritative wisdom. That's how they do it, by linking it to the name of King Solomon. As is clear in Ecclesiastes and in Job, what was considered wise behaviour in earlier times was judged to be inadequate in the changed circumstances of post-exilic Judah. The destruction of Jerusalem and its temple and the end of the monarchy called much of traditional wisdom into question. The diplomats made terrible errors. The kings behaved shockingly and made bad decisions, following the wisdom that they'd picked up. But it was messy and it was inadequate, so they're critical of that. Traditional wisdom that saw God as rewarding the good with success, and there's plenty of that in the wisdom literature, and punishing the rebellious, couldn't satisfy people's questions. It's just not working like that. Prosperity and success could no longer be thought of as necessarily indicating divine blessing. It could be greed. A new understanding is needed, a new wisdom. Exilic and post-exilic wisdom literature stresses the fact that we cannot comprehend God. We must apply our minds as honestly as we can, but ultimately, wisdom shares in the mysterious transcendence of God. We must trust. We must live a righteous life. Just looking at that word righteous, it's a beautiful English word, but because of usage, it's become almost unintelligible. But let's look at the word itself, take it back to the origins. The English word righteous picks up an important nuance. If you look at it, it derives from two words. Right, that's obvious. The E-O-U-S, we can be forgiven for not recognising that that's actually the word wise that's corrupted in the language. So to be righteous is to be right wise, to be wise as to what is right. It's a pretty beautiful virtue. Right with God primarily, but also right with the world. True, appropriate, right. Dermot Cox has written a book on the Proverbs. The reference is there, and he writes this. Wisdom is clearly an art to be learned by all who are caught up in daily affairs. The art of choosing the right way, of knowing how to distinguish in each situation of life what is right, what is conducive to the good. All this is totally obvious to all of us. We're living with this all the time. But it's important just, I think, to name it and to see that that's what we're dealing with in this wisdom literature of the Older Testament. Very little of it will apply to us today, obviously. If some of it didn't even apply after the exile, because it was wise as best people could work it out in the limited world of the pre-exile Judah and Israel, well, if someone reads the Book of Wisdom and follows it literally today in a totally different world, well, you'd have to say that rather stupid. I'm not meant to do that. We've got to try and see the wisdom, the values, and then see how does that, might that apply to us. While wisdom is essentially practical and evidence-based, its goal is for the individual and the community to enjoy this beautiful favourite word in the Jewish world, shalom. Shalom, we often translate it peace, and that's a good meaning, but shalom happens when the weather's beautiful, they've had a drop of lambs that is wonderful, and there's peace everywhere, families are happy, everyone's living their life to the full, the music's good, the kids are growing up happy, the old people are sitting around playing chess, they do in those days. Like it's just a very, very wholesome, wonderful life. That's what shalom is. Living life to the full. In the important enterprise that is the seeking of wisdom, trust is founded on the belief that God, quoting from Psalm 1, knows the way of the right wise. Of the righteous. God knows the way. And so if I can be in communion with God and listen, God will guide me and my wife and my children and my neighbour. He'll call us on a way that is truly wise. One of the basic ideas, and I want to deal with this now with you, is this fear of Yahweh. It's a term that comes all the way through the Bible, as you're going to see in a moment. Fear of Yahweh, fear of the Lord, is seen as the foundation of wisdom, often said that way. Maybe the word of is the problem. Again, we're dealing with a genitive thing. We're dealing with two nouns that are related, fear and the Lord. And the of is linking them, but not necessarily part of it. It's fear in relation to the Lord. But what does it mean? Is it fear of the Lord? Do we really mean that the Lord is the object of our fear? We're afraid of God, we might say. Sometimes, yes, that's a little bit of the element in their world. It shouldn't be in ours. But basically, is it fear that comes from God? God fear, gifted fear. Fear that actually comes from God, awe before the sacred. Is that what its basic meaning is? I think it is, but I'll undo that for you. Isaiah, you recall, I just jumped over it then, but you know, and Isaiah has the gifts of the Spirit, we call them for confirmation. And one of them is fear of the Lord. That's a gift. And in our understanding, thanks to Jesus and thanks to John, who knew Jesus and said, look, love casts out all fear, for God's sake, don't be afraid. And Jesus' own words in the Bible are quite instructive. He says, what are you going to be afraid of? The only one worth being afraid of is the one who has the power to cast body and soul into hell. And by that he means God. If you're going to be afraid of anything, don't be afraid of him or her or what people can do to your body or what people can do. No, no, no. If you're going to have fear, well, fear God, because God's the only one who can cast your body and soul into hell, says Jesus. And that doesn't sound too good, really, till you read the next sentence. And then he says, what do you do fearing God for? A sparrow doesn't fall to the ground without God getting very upset. And he loves you more than the sparrow. So, don't be afraid, little flock. So if you're going to be afraid of God. And everyone says, oh, yeah, that's what. And then Jesus said, well, don't do that, for God's sake. Well, that's crazy. So get fear out of your life, is what Jesus is asking us. The fear of Yahweh is seen as the foundation of wisdom. Here's the word of Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. The Spirit of wisdom, understanding, counsel, might, knowledge, and fear of Yahweh. Yahweh fear. His delight is in the fear of Yahweh. That fear that Yahweh gives, which is a sense of the sacred, sense of awe, a sense of a mystery, a sense of something that cannot be comprehended, but it's actually quite beautiful and it's a gift. And that takes away every other fear that we might play with. The psalmist states, this is Psalm 111, verse 10, the fear of Yahweh, I'll keep translating it that way, the fear of Yahweh is the beginning of wisdom. A sense of the awesome presence of the sacred is the beginning of wisdom. Happy are those, says Psalm 112, who fear Yahweh. And this is what he means by fear Yahweh. This is typical of poetry in the Psalms. They'll say something and then the next line will say it in different words. The equal idea. So it says, happy are those who fear the Lord. Next line, that is, who delight gratefully in God's, greatly in God's commands. That's what it means. Who listen to God and follow God's way, which is wise and beautiful. Here's Psalm 128. Happy is everyone who fears Yahweh. You can see why in English we're going to deal with this very carefully. For us, it doesn't mean we're afraid of God. Happy is everyone who fears Yahweh. What's that mean? Who walks in his ways. That's what it means. Takes God really seriously and follows. You shall eat the fruit of the labour of your hand. You'll be happy. Everything will go well with you, says the psalmist. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. Thus shall the man be blessed who fears Yahweh. And a lot of the Psalms, a lot of the literature of the Ancient Testament is actually addressed to males because they're the only ones that read, they're the only ones who went to school, and then they obviously explained it all to their wife at home, something like that. So you find a lot of male language, necessarily, probably, because they're the ones reading, listening, going to school. We have to do something with that, but that's their world. Job declares, truly, the fear of Yahweh, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. So fear of Yahweh is taking God seriously and departing from evil and listening to the way. In the New Testament, as a response to God as revealed by Jesus, John can write, this is in the first letter, chapter 4, there's no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears hasn't reached perfection in love. So prior to Jesus, it's understandable that God was at times seen as an object of fear. Going back on what I've said, real fear. All the people were fearful of their God because God is the cause of lightning. God is the cause of earthquakes, all of which happened in this little narrow part of the world called Israel. God is the cause of battles that you lose because God's organizing it, they thought. So we lost a battle against the Moabites or against the Edomites. Well, God must be angry with us, so we should be afraid. And if we don't do the right thing, God might come and whatever, ruin our crops. So prior to Jesus, it's understandable that God was at times seen as an object of fear because they assumed God controlled everything, and therefore everything that happened came from God. By the way, we did that too for a while. I don't know how you were taught, but I wouldn't be surprised if you were taught that God organized the crucifixion to save us, we were told, and everyone's supposed to be happy with that. So Jesus died on the cross. Well, if Jesus died on the cross, God must have planned it. That's the logic. So if God planned it, then we had to try and find good reasons for God planning the crucifixion. Surely to God we can just break from that crazy theology and just think, no, actually God didn't crucify Jesus. The Roman soldiers did, with the push from coming from the temple. That was murder, that was violence, that was sin. And God doesn't organize sin, for God's sake, and injustice and all that. God's role, if you want to find God on Calvary, what's that medieval hymn? Ubi caritas et amor Deus ibi est. Where there is charity and love, that's where God is. So we know God is on Calvary, present there. Where? With the soldiers nailing Jesus for some eternal purpose that God had, or cut it out. If we want to find where God is, we better look where. Where's love? Well, Mary of Magdala is nice. Mary the mother, the beloved disciple. That bloke, one of the soldiers who had pity on Jesus and offered him some drugged wine so that he might be not in so much pain, probably got sacked for it later, who knows. And some of the crowd, but basically we're looking at Jesus and we see, that's where you see God, loving. That's what God's doing on Calvary, not crucifying his son, loving through his son. But go back prior to Jesus, they didn't have that beautiful experience that we've had. But what we did, I hope you can see, is this is what happened. Jesus came, the New Testament comes, but because the Bible was there, we brought in a whole lot of stuff from the cult and from the commandments and from that, because it was all inspired by God. We brought it in and it infected Christianity. So Christian teaching was a mixture of what Jesus had come to say, and when he got rid of so much stuff, we brought it back. We've got to be careful we don't keep doing it. So the expression fear of Yahweh, however, focuses more radically on a gift received from God, the source of all wisdom. A sense of the sacred at the heart of the world, a sense that inspires awe and wonder and openness to mystery. It's this reverence that expands our experience of the everyday. Relying on God and putting our trust in God, we have the courage to explore experience, knowing that however easy or hard our circumstances may be, God, who has chosen us as his own, is at the heart of the world that God is immanent in but transcends. So that could, should, will please God, rid us of any other trivial fear that gets in the road because of God, our awe. And for us, thanks to Jesus, we're awestruck by the love. That's what we're awestruck by. Wisdom is at times in the ancient scriptures personified, and you don't find that in the Assyrian, Babylonian, Egyptian, other Eastern, right? You don't find it anywhere except in the Bible, the personification of wisdom. And we're here getting little inklings, by the way, because this will all be applied to Jesus, someone greater than Solomon here. And so wisdom and word go closely together. And a lot of the hymns in Paul that you'll read, they're taken from the wisdom literature. So Jesus is the expression of God's word, of course. He's the Word made flesh. He's also the wisdom incarnate. Well, here, go back to the ancient texts, which weren't thinking of Jesus. Though wisdom is written in the book, we're not sure exactly when, but in the last years of BC or the early years of AD. So it may have been written during Jesus' boyhood. And it reads, Yahweh, that's the Lord, Yahweh created me, wisdom, at the beginning of his work. Ages ago I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When he established the heavens, I, wisdom, was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I, wisdom, I was beside him like a master worker, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the human race. It's a lovely piece of writing, and it seemed to be, he's writing in a Greek world, of course, where they've got so many petty ideas of wisdom that are all organising, keeping things in order. This is vaster than all of that. The text continues, my children, listen to me, divine wisdom. Come to me, all you who labour and are burdened. That's a wisdom statement. My children, listen to me. Happy are those who keep my ways, says wisdom. Hear instruction and be wise. Do not neglect it. Happy is the one who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting beside my doors. For whoever finds me finds life and obtains favour from the Lord. Those who miss me injure themselves. All who hate me love death. The author is writing to young Jews in Alexandria who are very impressed with Aristotle and Pythagoras and all the Greek world, and they're getting caught up in the wonderful wisdom that's, and it is there to be caught up. And this teacher's saying, for God's sake, look at your own roots. We've got a wisdom here in our Torah and in our Jewish world that is far superior to anything at all you're reading out there. Get in touch with your own roots. That's what we have to do today too, of course, with the World Wide Web and the young, particularly unlike me in my youth, where I just had St. Kieran's school and mum and dad and home and the Marish brothers and so on. I lived in a little world, many of you would have. But they don't today. And so we're impressed with all this stuff. And we're trying to hand on through the family, of course, basically, the wonderful wisdom that we have as disciples of Jesus. Well, he's trying to do that here too. Not to Jesus, but to the wisdom of the Jewish world. To quote Cox again, wisdom is a channel by which God can reach out to humanity and draw humanity to himself, led by the voice of creation and its inherent mystery. We cannot comprehend God. We cannot comprehend life. God appeals to us through wisdom to live reflective lives. In this way, we'll play our part in ordering the world for God, in building communities that will bring about the reign of God in this world, the reign of love. In his book that I was given recently as a gift, and I'm very pleased with it, it's a book called Jesus, an Historical Approximation by a Spanish priest, Jose Pagola, and he writes there, a quote from him, Jesus, the poet of God's mercy, must have found this psalm, quoted in a moment, of thanksgiving especially meaningful. And he quotes Psalm 145. The Lord, Yahweh, is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. The Lord is good to all and has compassion over all that is made. All your works will give thanks to you, O Lord. And an important hint, if I may, comes to me to say it to you. Yahweh isn't a name for God. We can't name God. To name is to put a little tag on it and put it somewhere. When Moses asked God, what is your name? Who are you? Meaning, are you the God of the mountain? Are you the God of the desert? Are you the God of the stars? I mean, who are you? And God pretty well says, look, you can't name me. I'll be who I will be. Eye asher eye. I will be who I will be. That's my business. You just go, do what I'm calling, and you'll find me there, waiting for you at each step of your life. So whenever we use, and we're using it all the time, either the Lord, which is the from the Greek, really, kurios, or if we use the word Yahweh, which is the Hebrew, whenever we use that, we're not just thinking God. We're thinking the God of Moses, the God of the burning bush, the God of redemption, the God who took his people out. It's a historical connection that we've got to make all the time, or we miss it. It becomes an abstract thing, another word for God. No, it's not. It's this special God of the Old Testament scriptures. He goes on to say, the prophet, this is Pagola, the prophet who unconditionally accepted sinners, that's Jesus, must have been encouraged by this psalm. And then he quotes another psalm, Psalm 103. The Lord is merciful, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. He doesn't always accuse. Does no one condemn you? Jesus says to the woman caught in adultery, and she says, no. He said, well, I don't condemn you. God isn't accusing her. He says, don't sin anymore, darling. You're too beautiful for that. He loves her out of her distracted or whatever way. The Lord won't always accuse, nor will he keep his anger forever. He doesn't deal with us according to our sins. As a father has compassion for his children, so the Lord has compassion for those who revere him. These are wisdom psalms, and they're all part of what I'm sharing with you. And Pagola continues, the defender of the poor, this is Jesus, the poor and humiliated, must have sung these words with special joy. He's imagining Jesus singing these ancient wisdom psalms that he picked up from his dad and his mum. Lord, this is Psalm 135, who is like you? You deliver the weak from those too strong for them, the weak and needy from those who despoil them. If that's what God's doing, let's be part of it and let us do it. Let God do it through us. And again, continuing Pagola, he must have identified passionately with this prayer for the poor, Psalm 74. Don't forget the life of the poor forever. The plea. Have regard for your covenant, for the dark places of the land are full of the haunts of violence. So the gospel writers quote from the Psalms to help convey Jesus' teaching. Matthew 13:35. This, says he, commenting on what Jesus has done, is to fulfill the word spoken through the prophet. That's actually from the Psalm, Psalm 78. I'll open my mouth to speak in parables. I'll proclaim what has been hidden from the foundations of the world. Matthew commenting on Jesus' parables. Matthew again, quoting from Psalm 62, the Son of Man is to come with the angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay everyone for what has been done. Matthew quoting, Matthew's the one who does it most, quoting Psalm 8, Jesus said to them, have you never read, out of the mouths of babes and infants you have prepared praise for yourself? Jesus quoting that to the priests who are objecting to his to the children crying out on what we call Palm Sunday. Again, quoting Psalm 118 now, Matthew 21. Jesus said to them, "Have you never read in the scriptures the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone? This was the Lord's doing. It's amazing in our lives." So at least we know that Matthew is bringing that psalm in to support what Jesus is doing and to help Jews who are not yet Christians see Jesus as the fulfillment of the wisdom of the Psalms. That at least we know he may even be directly quoting something that Jesus actually said, quite likely. But we can't be sure of that always. Jesus challenges the idea of the Messiah when he says they know who the Messiah is going to be from their tradition. It's going to be, some say it's a priest, high priest. Most say it's going to be a king who leads the army, and etc., etc. And he says, just to get them thinking, David himself, by the Holy Spirit, declared, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I put your enemies under your feet." So, if the Messiah is a son of David, why is David talking about my Lord? Doesn't that make something higher than David? It's just puzzling them, trying to get them to realize their theology wasn't yet too wise. Jesus responds to those who accuse him of making himself equal to God. This is the Gospel of John. Be careful with the Gospel of John. Every time someone objects to something, they're always wrong. It gives John the occasion to say, "Oh, no, that's not what I'm saying." It comes out of the debates going on in the early church. So some people would have claimed to the Christians, "Hey, you're making Jesus equal to God." And John's saying, "No, we're not. That's not what we're doing." Jesus answered, "Is it not written in your law, I say you are gods?" So God, this, what are you talking about with gods? He's trying to get him to think again. And then he goes on beautifully to say, "Oh look, I'm not claiming to be equal with God. I only do what God does. I'm praying to God all the time. My meat is to do the will of my Father. Everything I do comes from God. He's not another God." Jesus speaks to those who've hated him and his Father. This is in John now, quoting Psalm 69. "It was to fulfill the word that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause." Jesus would have been steeped in the Psalms. Many of them he probably couldn't pray and left out. But he picked up the wisdom that's there in them and is quoting it throughout the Gospels. You'd expect that. He quotes early in John's Gospel from Psalm 78, "Our ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat." And he quotes the psalm, and then Jesus goes on to say, no, it wasn't Moses who gave them bread to eat. It was God who gives bread now. And Jesus is the bread, the nourishment. Quoting Psalm 41, this is John 13, the Last Supper. "I am not speaking of all of you. I know whom I've chosen, but to fulfill the scripture." Who wrote that, John or Jesus? Well, John wrote it. Is he quoting Jesus or is he bringing it here to help us understand Jesus? I don't know. But the quote is, "The one who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me." Judas. In the middle of the afternoon, they go back, we talked about it yesterday, they go back to Psalm 22 because it's so beautiful. And Matthew places it on the lips of Jesus. It was in the middle of the afternoon, the ninth hour, mid-afternoon, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, Eli is God, he is my, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me?" Are they the words that Jesus spoke from the cross? Matthew has it, the others don't, but that doesn't, they're there. It's quite interesting to follow that through. If you were to take Psalm 22 and read it through, I think it's verse 10, the words in the psalm are Eli Ata. Eli, my God, Ata, you. That could be the words that Jesus spoke. That might have been what took them to this psalm, because he was obviously praying in prayer and they could hear this Eli Ata. That's about all you could say if you're dying of asphyxiation on a cross. Getting one word out's hard enough. So maybe that's what Jesus said. I'm only guessing, or, well, suggesting. Eli Ata. What makes me think that could be the words that Jesus spoke is what happens in the gospel scene when they say, ha, he's calling on Elijah. Remember that? Where'd they get that from? Well, a little lesson in Aramaic. If you can tell the difference between Eli Ata and Elia Ta. Elia is Elijah, Ta is come. So, just a thought, and it's a bit of a distraction from what we're doing at the moment. But trying to get into the heart of what happened on Calvary and what Jesus was thinking and praying and suffering, obviously Mark, with Peter's help, and now Matthew picking it up from Mark, have taken us, and they're saying, go and read the whole psalm. It won't all apply to Jesus, of course, and it doesn't, but a lot of it is beautifully expressing. And when they actually describe what happened to Jesus on the cross, they take images from the psalm to help us do that. The dividing of the garments and many other things. Here's Luke. He goes in a different direction from the others. He has Jesus on the cross praying what every faithful Jew did at their night prayer before they went to bed. They prayed Psalm 31, which ends with, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. A beautiful ending of the little night prayer of a faithful. Taken from Psalm 31. They're the words that Luke places on Jesus' lips at the end. Having said this, he breathed his last.